You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, February 29th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pascoe. Wait, let me check that again. Yeah, February 29th. I thought they were kidding. Today, in leading Republican contender, unencumbered by reason, logic, or knowledge news, Donald Trump told the Today Show there was a reason he did not disavow his support of the Ku Klux Klan on CNN. Here's what he said.
Well, I know who he is, but I never met David Duke. So when you talk about it, I never met David Duke.
If ever there was a person for whom the phrase reputation precedes him, I'd say David Duke fits that mold. Look, I can't tell you if Harry Potter or Voldemort is a good guy. I never met either of them. I guess, like David Duke, they're both wizards. Maybe the lesson here is that there are good wizards and bad wizards. And dragons. By the way, is it better to be a grand wizard or a grand dragon? I looked it up for you because I know you were wondering too. Wizards are the highest, then dragons, then below them titans, and below the titans, giants. And giants are appointed and voted on by goblins. I'm not kidding about any of this. And there were also dens and a grand council of yahoos. Again, I'm not kidding. Speaking of the man destined to lead that grand council of yahoos, Trump, he went on to plead audio engineering troubles.
Okay, so let me tell you, I'm sitting in a house in Florida with a very bad earpiece that they gave me, and you could hardly hear what he was saying, but what I heard was various groups.
Okay, so let's hear that open to interpretation question that Trump was asked to see how he might have misheard it. Here's the original CNN interview with Jake Tapper.
Well, I have to look at the group. I mean, I don't know what group you're talking about. You wouldn't want me to condemn a group that I know nothing about. I have to look. If you would send me a list of the groups, I will do research on them. And certainly I would disavow if I thought there was something wrong. But you may have groups in there that are totally fine, and it would be very unfair. So give me a list of the groups, and I'll let you know.
Okay. I mean, I'm just talking about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan here, but...
Wait, what did Jake Tapper say? That was so confusing. Was he talking about... The Kukla, Fran, and Ollie show? Delightful old television show. Why would I disavow Kukla, Fran, and Ollie? Is this coming from Fibber McGee? What's that you say? The KKK? Did you say Kiki Vandeweghe? I'm confused. Of course, all manner of critic, which by now includes almost all of the professional Republicans, were lamenting the latest gaffe. But guess what? It's not a gaffe. What it is insensitive. And we, normal American adults, think of the word as insensitive as a defect. But to Trump, it's a virtue. Anytime Trump is insensitive, it scans to his legion of supporters as bold, honest, risk-taking. And they don't think it's racist. They think it's fine. We're being told that a lot of his support comes from racists. Maybe by our definition, but not by their definition. There are some David Duke types, but the majority of the people supporting Trump aren't. They're people who convince themselves that they themselves loathe David Duke types. Ergo, they're not racist. Ergo, Trump needn't apologize any more than I, a Donald Trump supporter, needs to apologize that some actual racist somewhere likes Donald Trump. Yeah, this has a little bit of the quality of the dragon chasing its own tail. And there's very, very little that is grand about it. On the show today, a post-Oscar joke recap. Chris Rock did a great job, but was Mad Max Fury Road's win for costume design enough to prevent global warming? A Gist investigation. But right now, let's look at the policies of Bernie Sanders from a big Bernie Sanders supporter and economic expert. So So in our week of Bernie bashing, light Bernie bashing with love, really just questioning his policies, somewhat of his tactics, I put out a call. Who can we get on to articulate why Bernie Sanders has some good and plausible and doable ideas? Well, after many suggestions, the name was raised, Matt Brunig. And I said, yeah, I like that guy. He writes for a lot of people, and he's on MattBrunig.com, Matt Brunig. He's kind of an expert on income inequality and issues of economics. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
So let's go in order. The two big complaints about Bernie is he can't get his agenda passed, and even if he does, his agenda might not be that good. Well, can he get it passed? I know you're not a political scientist. I know you look at things like economics, but there are some empirical arguments to whether it's reasonable to think that Bernie could get anything done. What do you think?
My impression is that he won't be able to get anything passed, but that's because there's going to be a Republican Congress, and so that's also going to prevent Hillary Clinton from getting anything passed as well.
Right. I have read your post saying that, yes, but all those arguments are true for Hillary. But isn't it true that, first of all, we can't know the future, and it's not impossible that over 4 or 8 years of a Bernie or Hillary presidency, at some point we'll get a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House? And when that happens, would it be fair to say, do you think it's fair to say that Bernie's agenda, as he states it, is just as likely as Hillary Clinton's agenda, given that if the House of Representatives flips, for instance, or the Senate, there will be a lot of moderate Democrats who I think what Bernie is proposing, a lot of things that are anathema to them.
So it's possible that, you know, he'd have to get a much bigger change in the composition of Congress than Hillary would to get her stuff done, which I think is the nut of that argument. But that's also, I don't think, particularly compelling. He hasn't shown himself to be a kind of all or nothing guy throughout his life. You know, he voted for Obamacare, worked on Obamacare, did that kind of stuff, even though he's not particularly fond of the approach. So I think in a scenario where he had to water it down to get it through a Democratic majority that's not as left-wing as he is, that
right, but then what would be the difference between him and Hillary? That she'd be getting her agenda passed, and that's really her agenda, but he'd be getting his agenda passed, and it's a watered-down version of his, if it's still the same thing. I mean, take, for instance, nationalized health care or single payer.
Right, so the point would be that that neutralizes the difference between them, and so then again, it's kind of irrelevant, and you just say, well, I like Bernie more. He has a more ambitious, sort of broader perspective on where things should go. And there's got to be at least some knock-on cultural effects to having this guy, you know, lead the country and maybe push it to the left in the long run. So,
in the context of America and what we have now, and where, well, how we think about how the world should be ordered, right? So, not Norway. Why is single payer a good idea for America?
Single payer is a good idea for any developed country, really. The issue that the United States has is it spends about 17% of its GDP on health care. Other developed countries spend on average around 9% or 10%. And that's a really big difference. 7 points of GDP, to the math off the top of your head, we're talking $1 trillion, something around there. And if you can redirect that GDP to other uses, including other social benefits, or even just as disposable income for households to spend, that's going to be a huge net increase for people's kind of bottom line and well-being.
Do you think that it would work? Do you think that the lift from going from our free market system, or quasi, well, mostly free market, even under Obamacare, to single payer, wouldn't that have several frictions that places like Canada, which already have single payer, either dealt with hundreds of years ago, or really, not hundreds, but 100 years ago, or didn't deal with at all?
So there are transitional difficulties that result from the fact that we've allowed ourselves to get where we've gotten. It would have been nice to have never gotten to the healthcare sector being 17% of GDP. So those transitional difficulties mean that you're going to have some extra costs in the short term. But one way to think about this is, let's suppose that we want to do this in a way that doesn't cut anyone back. That's the thing that people are usually worried about. If we go to single payer, well, if you're going to cut doctor reimbursements or medication, like, that's just going to create a real storm of dysfunction and people are really going to dislike it. Well, so one thing you could do is you could say, okay, we're going to do a single payer, and in the first year, we're going to basically pay people exactly what they're being paid right now. We're not going to cut doctor reimbursements. We're not going to cut prescription medicine payments or whatever. But going forward, we're going to freeze those payments for many, many years. And simply by freezing those payments, because the economy is going to grow, it will shrink, right? Its relative size will shrink as a percentage of the economy. So you could get there. You could get there if you wanted to kind of handle it that way. But that would create unique difficulties in that transitionary period because it would be sort of super costs while you're waiting for it to shrink.
Yeah, so the way I see it is I wouldn't mind living in a country like Canada or France as relates to healthcare. I understand the benefits. I understand the drawbacks. But since we're not there now, I think that it's such a tough slog to get there, and a much tougher slog than even to get to Obamacare. I don't know, but I think in his heart of hearts, if he could have snapped his fingers and gotten a single-payer system passed, Obama would have. But the political intelligence of not doing that is evident because he's able to defend the ACA against attacks, I think precisely because it wasn't such a huge lift. So I really do think you have to imagine, I know this is a conflation of politics and ideal policy, but you know, you really have to do, I think, take into account what the realities of politics are. And if it's so hard to defend the ACA, I don't think that there will be a permanent majority of representatives who will be in favor of single-payer health care. And I just think it would be even easier to dismantle that than what we're seeing now with Obamacare.
So to be clear, you say easily dismantle. Once you get single payer in place, I don't think it's ever going to go anywhere. I mean, that would be an even bigger disaster than trying to get there in the first place, because what are you going to do? I mean, you would literally be pulling people off of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moonshot maybe, but if you get it through, it's there. None of these other countries have anybody suggesting that they should unravel it or move to a private sector system or anything like that.
Right. So let's talk about what he talks about in terms of GDP and per capita growth. He's saying, his top advisor is saying, that we could get to 5.3% real GDP growth. That seems insanely high to me. When Jeb Bush had a plan of 4% growth, I think most reasonable economists said that would be extremely high in the post-World War II era. And here comes Bernie Sanders even topping that. Do you think that those estimates are a little pie in the sky?
Well, to clarify first, Gerald Friedman is
he's the economist at Massachusetts. Right. He's the University of Massachusetts professor who's Bernie cites as, you know, laying out the case for why this growth is possible from 2.1% per year to 5.3%.
Right. So he did this on his own, kind of published it, and it got cited in CNN story. And then one of their spokesperson was kind of like, this is fantastic. But it hasn't formed the basis of Bernie's policymaking. Aside from that, just focusing on his paper, if you want to make the comparison to Jeb was suggesting that we could get 4% growth kind of in perpetuity. Friedman's argument's a little bit different. He's saying that there would be such a huge spike of spending that would cause growth to shoot up enormously in the short term, and then it would fall back down.
Mm-hmm.
So the argument is that there's a lot of excess capacity in the economy, meaning there are a lot of people who could work but aren't working because there aren't enough jobs, or a lot of, you know, resources that aren't being mobilized that could be mobilized. And that if we really ramped up deficit spending in the short term, we could activate those resources. I have no idea if that means you could get to 10% in the short term or 8% or whatever. That's the exact level is something that's beyond my reach. But that's the argument. And it's really an argument about idle resources. How many idle resources do we actually have in the economy?
Do you have a problem with Sanders' lack of specificity? I mean, here we are talking about this plan that's not really his plan, that someone affiliated with the campaign said good plan. But, you know, where is his plan specifically?
I mean, he releases plans that there are details that are missing from them. I guess there is a question of how detailed you want.
Well, how detailed do you want? You could process, you could handle all this stuff. You're smarter than 99.9% of us on economic issues.
I like details. I'm interested in details. They fascinate me. But as a political campaign, I don't know that it matters more than to just kind of lay out, here's what I want to do. I want to have national health insurance. I want to have tuition-free education. when I have paid leave, I'm going to mandate vacation. And then those things are going to be worked out later, specifically how you do it. And Hillary, you know, her stuff's not terribly detailed as well. If you look at some of her plans, she has plans in which she says, oh, we're going to pay for this by reducing tax expenditures for high earners. You say, well, what does that mean? Are you going to cut 401ks? Are you going to cut mortgage interest tax deduction? What are you going to do here? There's lots of vagueness in all these plans.
And so we've mostly talked about economics issue. That's your area of expertise. Anything else you want to touch upon of his agenda that you think makes him superior to Hillary Clinton, or even something that gives you pause?
The thing that I guess appeals about Bernie is clearly, he's like a lifelong radical guy. I mean, you know what you're getting with Bernie. He was involved in the civil rights movement, got arrested, was involved in all these socialist parties when he was young, kind of been on that side his whole life. He lately has become much more moderate than he used to be. But to me, that's a pretty promising thing, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen in office, but you at least kind of know what their general orientation is and how they approach the world. With Hillary Clinton, she's very political, I guess. She sort of moves with the tides. In the 90s, she kind of became a little reactionary, and then now she's kind of moved back from that. So you never really know where she's headed or what her kind of deep views are. And that should be a little bit worrying, because you don't really know what she might do. I think it's very plausible that she'll agree to cut Social Security, for instance, because that's been a sort of bipartisan grand bargain kind of thing. That seems like it's in her wheelhouse. Unrelated to the policy agenda, there's the matter of known character. And if you're on the left, as I am, Bernie's clearly been more stable character on that side than Hillary has.
All right. Matt Brunig, who blogs and writes for a number of places. His site is mattbrunig.com. The Brunig is spelled B-R-U-E-N-I-G. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
And now the spiel, rock solid. Chris Rock was dubbed the funniest man in America by Time magazine in 2001. So since you got to figure that it takes a publication like Time magazine 5 or 6 years to get the joke, then you can conservatively calculate that Chris Rock has been the funniest person in America for 2 decades. Louis had his moments. Amy Schumer's having hers. Will Ferrell, Tina Fey, they're not stand-ups, but they also contributed mightily to our national funniness. But over the last 20 years or so, I'd say Chris Rock's the best. And on issues of race, he's good. He's almost too good. Early episodes of The Office dealt with Steve Carell's clueless manager thinking it was okay for him to tell Chris Rock jokes.
How come Chris Rock can do a routine and everybody finds it hilarious and groundbreaking, and then I go and do the exact same routine, same comedic timing, and people file a complaint to corporate? Is it because I'm white and Chris is black?
So if you take Chris Rock and throw him into an Oscars ceremony heavily criticized for its lack of diversity, and you've got, well, I think this was his best joke.
This thing, things are going to be a little different at the Oscars. This year, in the in memoriam package, it's just going to be black people that were shot by the cops on their way to the movies.
But as good as Chris Rock was, I'd like to point out something about the level of difficulty. To Chris Rock, this was a layup. Or to put it in Hollywood casting terms, this was like asking Daniel Day-Lewis to play a brooding eccentric in a period piece. So to say, as Robin Roberts said on Good Morning America today,
he went there.
Well, of course he went there. He was there. He lives there. And the there was all around him. I say that this wasn't a hard gig at all, primarily because Chris Rock is the funniest American of the last 20 years. But he's also the perfect guy to crack jokes to a guilty, nervous, mostly white audience who wanted absolution in the form of a light hazing that served the public purpose of self-flagellation, but really just a light back scratching. It's not that Rock didn't bring the pain. It's just that the Hollywood establishment is so anesthetized by wealth and power, they're immune to any real sting. But to hear Good Morning America tell the tale, Chris Rock was...
His analysis, a speaking truth to power moment,
earning the laughter of recognition.
Chris Rock was Marian Anderson singing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial after the Daughters of the American Revolution denied her a place in Constitution Hall. Look it up if your frame of reference for artistic snubs extends only as far back as Michael B. Jordan in Creed. Good Morning America overlooked or whitewashed. Oh, he went there. Certain dynamics. Granted, this morning's Good Morning America was hosted literally on the Oscar stage by some of the same journalists who are part of the pre-show package at the service of their corporate bosses who are promoting literally their biggest night of broadcasting of the year. And yeah, Chris Rock was making funny jokes. He deserves credit for craftsmanship. But he was also benefiting from the release of tension. The crowd laughed in appreciation and it sighed in relief. That's why some of my favorite jokes were the ones that were slightly off of the official talking points of the Oscars So White movement, like when he put the importance of this protest in greater context.
I'm sure there were no black nominees some of those years, say 62 or 63, and black people did not protest. Why? Because we had real things to protest at the time. You know? Too busy being raped and lynched to care about who won best cinematographer. You know, when your grandmother's swinging from a tree, it's really hard to care about best documentary foreign short.
Can you tell I like the really tough stuff? This to me is a good joke. It is not, strictly speaking, a good point. It posits that one can only be upset about the gravest indignities. It treads upon injustice one-upsmanship, which I've talked about, right? How can you care about the Oscars when black citizens are disenfranchised? Well, how can you care about American disenfranchisement when they're literally poisoning Flint? Oh, how does Flint even compare to how Boko Haram is marauding in Nigeria? I get all of this. And I get that it's a very nice position not to have to choose between indignities, right? Ask a black person, all right, you got to pick one. It's either Oscar diversity or over-policed inner cities. Which one's your issues? Because no one asks me as a white person in America, all right, you got to pick one. Do you want to not be harassed by cops or do you want a pretty easy path to get a bank loan? You just get one. I don't just get one. I get both. I get them all. And this way I can concentrate on the white man's greatest problem in America, Cam Newton's touchdown celebrations. So I say this to acknowledge that, yeah, even if Oscar diversity isn't the defining moral issue of our time, of course it's something to think about and something to change. But I did have this thought. The Oscars are mostly liberal. The Academy, right? Mostly white, mostly old. Causes championed by Hollywood that we heard about last night are things like global warming and big banks. And all of that, that's all Bernie Sanders issues. But issues of race, that's Hillary Clinton's defining issue this election. Yeah, I'll acknowledge it's an imperfect analogy. But on the day before, a pretty select cabal bestowed acting awards in a somewhat discriminatory manner. Almost 400,000 people voted in a real election in South Carolina. That election got attention, but it got less attention than the Oscars. And in that election, the vote of black people were more than the difference. It was the tide. Black voters, South Carolina proved, the will of black voters will determine the Democratic primary. I'm not going to get into which candidate should get the African-American vote. I'm just saying, if you are a fan of democracy and living in democracy, and African-Americans expressed who they wanted to vote for, that Hillary Clinton did get almost all of the African-American vote. The African-American vote will almost certainly propel her to becoming the nominee. It's not a nomination for Michael B. Jordan. And it would be great one day to see Hillary Clinton and Michael B. Jordan giving an acceptance speech. But until that day comes, the much more important development in terms of racial justice in America happened on Saturday, not Sunday. And the picture it presents is a lot more optimistic to boot. That's it for today's show. Just producer Andrea Salenzi thought we were asking her to disavow a hate group, not that she hates Goop. She loves that site. Slate executive producer Steve Lickteig had a crappy earpiece and thought he was agreeing to a second helping of Italian ISIS, not to helping ISIS. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, He had an ISDN line go down, didn't realize the chant he was leading. I mean, there really is just a thin difference between Muammar Gaddafi and Nomar Gaddafi. The gist, really, when you think about it, why would I want to toast an activist from PETA and consume her as she was dipped in olive oil? I was clearly talking about the bread, which, by the way, is great with chicken shawarma. Oh, no. Now both PETAs hate me. Peru, de Peru, du Peru. And thanks for listening.